All rise. All persons having business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims, draw nigh and give your attention, for this court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. The court is prepared to hear the case of Catherine Roberson versus Secretary of Veterans Affairs. Are counsel ready to proceed? All right, Ms. Booth, you have 30 minutes to argue. Do you wish to reserve any time?
I've reserved 10 minutes.
10 minutes, all right. Mr. Sullivan, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
All right, Ms. Booth, you may proceed.
Good morning, and thank you, Your Honor. Mrs. Roberson appeals from a 2005 VBA decision which denied her claim for a higher rating for the veteran's split disabilities, and that's pertinent, of course, to the accrued benefits claim. She also appeals the board's denial of DIC under the no-fault provisions of former 38 U.S.C. 1151. With the court's permission, I would like to first address the matter upon which Judge Lance requested additional briefing, and that is whether the general counsel's opinion at 5-2001 has any applicability or effect on this case. In our view, Your Honors, it does not. There are several reasons for this. The most outstanding is that that general counsel's opinion cannot be reconciled with the Gardner case, which interpreted 1151 as having no language of fault in it and said that it would be unreasonable to read fault language into it. Mrs. Roberson's case was, of course, brought under the former 1151. So the general counsel's opinion, because it's contrary to that, simply would be invalid. I'm not sure, though, that the court needs to review it or that the court has jurisdiction to review it. I noticed that Mr. Sullivan, in his supplemental memorandum, suggested to the court that it not review this issue because, in the Secretary's view, Mrs. Roberson was not entitled to relief based on the facts of the case. I think he may be right about the court's, whether the court should review it, although respectfully, I would say for the wrong reason.
Counselor, let me interrupt you here.
Certainly.
For just a moment. You're familiar with the Haas case decided by the Federal Circuit.
Yes.
And the way the Haas case was decided in the 59-page opinion, doesn't that require us to give some level of deference to the general counsel's opinion in as much as that is an interpretation of the agency's own regulation?
Well, I think not in this particular case because after Gardner, the general counsel's opinion, and even subsequently the 2004 amended regs, which reinsert the negligence standard retrospectively to claims filed before 1997, any deference those views would have been entitled to have already, I think that's already been decided by this court, the Federal Circuit, and the Supreme Court in Gardner, which all three said there is no fault standard under the former provisions of 1151. The distinction that the general counsel's opinion seeks to make is between essentially sins of omission versus sins of commission, but that distinction is not found in the statute. The presidential opinion itself acknowledges that 1151 makes no difference between acts of omission versus commission and agrees that an act of omission, such as a failure to diagnose, is indeed an 1151 claim. Once we get to that point, there is nowhere for the Secretary to go with this general counsel's opinion. Gardner is definitive and final. The 1997 amendment to the statute, whereby Congress reinserted the negligence standard, has no application. This is not a Rodriguez case because there is no this general counsel's opinion, as well as the amended reg in 2004.
Counsel, if I may interrupt for a moment, I'd like to back up to where you say once we decide that a failure to diagnose or an act of omission has occurred, we don't need to go any further. How do we decide that a failure to diagnose has occurred?
I think the semantics get a little tricky here. If we refer to it as a failure to diagnose, that implicitly suggests that there's been a breach of some duty, because otherwise you would not have failed to do something that you're not required to do. At one point, and I meant to go back through and double check that I was consistent throughout the brief, but I know early on in the briefing I referred to this as the non-diagnosis, and I think that's the correct way to view it under the no-fault statute, and that would just be a matter of fact. That's a question of looking at the medical records while Mr. Robertson was under the care and treatment of the VA and see if there's a diagnosis there. There's not. So there was no diagnosis.
Right, but I am aware that in the record it states that the cancer may have started either 8 to 4 months or 6 to 4 months prior to its actual diagnosis in this case. But I haven't seen in the record where it says when such a diagnosis could have been made. When was the cancer detectable?
Well, the
And does that matter?
I don't think it matters, because the critical the disease, or the aggravation of the disease in this case, is not the original cancer. Obviously, VA, there's no causal connection between anything VA did and the initial diagnosis of cancer, or the onset of cancer. Dr. Pritchard, who was a treating physician at Riverside Methodist Hospital, and who was, I don't know if he personally made the diagnosis, but it was made during that admission and under his care. Dr. Pritchard said that it was most likely of origin in the lung, and he based that on the clinical findings and the from the fine needle biopsy of the lung. That, if you look carefully, is really not disputed, or at least not the VA's experts are very precise. Or maybe not precise enough. What they say is that, number one, they disagree that the initial diagnosis or that the origin was in the lung. But then if you look why they say that, they, number one, say there is no clinical evidence, but of course there is, the need of fine needle biopsy. And number two, they also say that excuse me, Your Honor, may I get a glass of water? I do beg your pardon. Thank you. The rationale for their saying that it was not of origin in the lung was not that they thought it was someplace else, but rather that it just could have been several other places. So they didn't make, they don't actually, if you look in the whole context of their opinion, they're not actually disputing Dr. Pritchard's placement of origin in the lung so much as they're saying that's not definitive.
And right, but Dr. Pritchard, if I'm remembering correctly, also doesn't say when you could have determined that it, if let's assume it was lung cancer as the originating point, he doesn't say when that could have been diagnosed. He only talks about when the cancer originated.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just wondering if VA couldn't have diagnosed the treatment, diagnosed the cancer at any of the points when Mr. Roberson had presented for treatment, how is VA causally connected to his circumstance?
I think the causal connection is does not require a showing under the no-fault statute. The causal connection issue does not require Mrs. Robertson to present evidence that it could have been diagnosed at an earlier time. All the physicians on both sides, and I say both sides guardedly, Dr. Pritchard was really just reciting his own views in response to a letter that Mrs. Robertson asked him to write many years ago and never really got involved in the case from an adversarial point of view. But Dr. Pritchard and VA's doctors agree that there is this at least at most a 6 month, at least a 4 month window when the veteran had the onset of his cancer, whatever the original site was. As late, so that would place it somewhere in.
But don't you have to have, doesn't the veteran have to have been in the VA hospital?
No, Your Honor.
You don't have to be in the VA hospital, but you have to be receiving VA treatment.
VA medical care, hospitalization, those with the.
All right,
so. The two that might be pertinent
so
here.
Do we have VA hospitalization?
We do not.
Do we have VA medical treatment?
We did not have VA medical treatment of the cancer because that was never diagnosed.
Okay,
VA,
so,
however.
But you're only entitled to compensation under 1151 as a result of those things, right?
Well, the VA medical care, that's correct, but the VA medical care was the continuing course of general care that
provided
to him.
When did Mr. Robertson present to VA for a condition for which there would have been a diagnosis of cancer?
The initial turning point, in my view, is during that 1995 April, May, June time period, looking retrospectively at the past months right before that, where there was a general deterioration. In April, a VA physician evaluated his complaints and apparently attributed them to stroke residuals, although he did not explain why that was, nor did he take on any additional evaluation. I believe that
well,
VA
let me,
physician...
Let me just ask you a hypothetical.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm in the VA hospital for treatment for knee replacement,
mm-hmm.
and you're treating me for that knee replacement, and then 3 months later I discover that I have prostate cancer,
mm-hmm.
and that prostate cancer had its onset while I was being treated for my knee replacement, would that entitle me to 1151 compensation?
That's a closer case.
A closer case?
I think it is because in the instance you're talking about, the veteran or you, Judge Green, have presented for treatment of a particular ailment.
All right. So what did Mr. Robertson present for at the VA hospital?
Well, he didn't have to present to the hospital. And,
or to the VA center.
And
VA
medical treatment
right.
includes, under 3.358, it includes a VA medical examination. Mr. Robertson presented at least as late as April with complaints that were attributed to his stroke residuals.
His what?
Stroke residuals. He had a stroke in 1978, which was non-disabling. He had a second stroke in 1990. Which was sufficiently disabling that his work, he testified that he was granted disability because of it. The stroke, of course, is not related to the claim, the DIC claim.
Well, let's stop right there.
Okay.
You're saying that there was I'll use the word failure to diagnose cancer at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's when he presented for his stroke residuals. You're saying that there should have been a diagnosis for cancer.
Well, I'm looking at this, Your Honor. Number one, when he presented, the VA physician assumed that he had additional stroke residuals, but there is no evidence that he had another stroke. In fact, that is consistent with the CT scan, the first CT scan done at Riverside Hospital in June.
There was no finding. It was normal. Is that correct?
Well, they noted that there was an old infarct, but there was, and the purpose of doing that CT scan at Riverside, which is a private hospital where Mrs. Robertson took her husband in frustration that they did not perceive the VA treatment center to be responsive to what they both viewed as his deteriorating condition over within those past few months. The purpose of the CT scan, according to the Riverside records, was to rule out a trans ischemic attack or to rule out an additional CVA.
That was same kind of treatment he received in Columbus?
No, it differs in an important respect. VA presumed, without doing any evaluation, that it was caused by stroke residuals, worsening stroke residuals. Riverside made the assumption that it might be something else, and the first thing that they do is rule out the stroke residuals, which I believe the CT scan either does or at least places it in raises a large question.
But they didn't make any diagnosis of any lung cancer at that time either, did they?
They did not, and they did not evaluate him for lung cancer. But, Your Honor, what is very interesting is that the CT scan shows that at least is consistent with no brain metastasis at that point. That's important because had he been diagnosed with lung cancer and treated, and Dr. Pritchard's opinion is a little vague, but I think the only way you can read it, put it in context and read it, is that had he been diagnosed before brain metastases, his particular small cell carcinoma, which Dr. Pritchard viewed as originating in the lung, was what he described as normally very responsive to treatment. But in this case, because when he presented for diagnosis in August at Riverside, he already had extensive metastases throughout his body. The brain metastasis seems to have been the most concern, and in fact, they did attempt to treat that with chemo and radiation through Riverside because the veteran spouse insisted on it. The clear reading of Dr. Pritchard's notes are that they felt it was a hopeless case at that point.
I'd like to get back to the elements of an 1151 claim. You have to demonstrate that there's an injury. In this instance, what would you assert is the injury?
The injury is the delay in the disability caused by the delay between onset of lung cancer and metastases to the brain. Because at that point, had that diagnosis been made during that time period, the evidence from Dr. Pritchard is that it's a very treatable form of cancer. Even the VA's doctors said that that cancer victims who present with brain metastasis normally survive 10 months. That's the median time. Mr. Robertson survived about 2 months.
So then, moving along, what would be the causal connection between this injury and the VA treatment?
Mm-hmm. The fact that VA evaluated his residuals in April and again in June, I believe. In June, he already had difficulties speaking, and he was expressing great frustration with his increasing disability. And that was not evaluated. Instead, he was diagnosed with an adjustment disorder. So there are two critical points aside from, and Mr. Robertson also treated at the VA outpatient center continuously through this time period. He didn't just show up in April.
What were his
and
complaints?
Come back again in June.
What were his complaints when he presented?
The outpatient center, do you mean generally, Your Honor?
Well, were there any respiratory complaints or lung complaints or complaints?
He had.
I mean, if he presented for his his foot condition, would he been would it have been expected for them to do a diagnosis on his lungs?
No, Your Honor, he had an increasing physical debility, I guess. He had downgraded from being able to ambulate to being in a wheelchair. VA recommended physical therapy, and he apparently walked with cane for a very short period of time. He was having increasing difficulties communicating, and the difficulties with walking. I'm sorry, I managed to walk out without my briefs and notes this morning, so I really am hoping I'm prepared for this. But the difficulties with walking did not appear to be related to his foot disability so much as a stamina issue.
Okay.
But it was a very general kind of debilitation. And, Your Honor, I see my time is up.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Sullivan.
May it please the Court, Your Honors. I'm Thomas Sullivan, representing Secretary of Veterans Affairs James B. Peek, M.D., and with me today at council table is Gail Stroman. Your Honors, the Secretary is mindful that Mr. Roberson had significant medical disabilities, which led to his untimely death. However, the Secretary would submit that this is not as difficult a case as it might appear with the volume, the size of the record, and with the compelling brief that the appellant has submitted. As Judge Holand pointed out, under old pre-amended 38 U.S.C. 1151, a claimant was required to show that there was an injury or aggravation that resulted in additional disability that was a direct result of VA hospitalization, medical or surgical treatment, vocational rehab, consequent to an examination. And I'm paraphrasing the statute, but I believe that essentially I have it right, those four elements. Judge Sholin, as you alluded to and you asked appellant's counsel, what was the injury? The initial injury in this case, if one were to prevail on this theory of failure to diagnose, would be the failure to diagnose. You would have to make that showing. Here, the Secretary believes that the board decision is plausibly based on the medical evidence because both the medical opinions of record are inconclusive as to whether or not VA failed to diagnose anything. And if, with the court's indulgence, I would direct you to Dr. Pritchard's medical opinion in the record at page 1054. And I'll quote from it. Dr. Pritchard said that the disease process was advanced at the time of diagnosis. It was likely that it had advanced quickly, that it had not been present for a long period of time, that it was unclear how long before diagnosis that it could have been detected. And then he opined that the onset of 4 to 8 months prior to diagnosis in August of 1995 would have been reasonable. The VA medical opinion provided by Drs. Edlis, a VA oncologist at the Bronx VA Medical Center, and Dr. Allen, put the onset in a likely range of 4 to 6 months. They noted that neither of the brain metastases were detectable in June of 1995. They noted that the neck mass also had a similar growth rate as the neck or as the brain metastases. And they noted that the disease process was not present on testing prior to July 1995. In March of 1995, at the time of Mr. Roberson's last incident of actual VA hospitalization or treatment, there was no evidence to suggest that any cancer was present and that he presented with no symptoms during his treatment or his subsequent vocational rehabilitation stint with the VA that was suggestive of a medical condition that warranted further investigation.
If I can interrupt for a moment.
Certainly.
do the VA doctors state whether the lung cancer was detectable?
No, they do not. And in fact, Your Honor, they are not conclusive on the origin of the cancer itself. They actually say
that lung could be one of the locations.
Yes, exactly. And they noted that there were several metastases, and they base that on the idea that the pneumonia, the aspirate pneumonia that was part of the cause of death, was not the kind of pneumonia that one suffers from a cancer-related condition in the lung. The Secretary would also like to point out that it's really important to understand here that onset does not mean that the condition was diagnosable. The plain meaning of the word onset means to begin or to commence. So the medical evidence would show that the cancer disease process began or commenced perhaps sometime within that range that he was receiving VA treatment, and the Secretary certainly would not, the Secretary can count. However, the VA cannot fail to diagnose a condition that is not diagnosable or detectable.
Counsel, I'd like to discuss the Jackson case,
mm-hmm.
which seems to imply that it doesn't matter whether VA had any fault or failure to do something. It's just if the person was hospitalized and something bad happened to them while they were hospitalized, that's causal connection enough. So how is that not applicable in this case, that he was hospitalized, he happened to get cancer at the time that VA was treating him, and under Jackson, wouldn't that be enough?
Well, I would submit, Your Honor, I'm not certain that he had cancer at the time or that it was detectable enough to be diagnosable. Obviously, a cancer process is very different from the injury that was alleged in Jackson.
Right, but under Jackson, it sort of seems to me that it doesn't matter, perhaps, whether it was detectable or not, just whether he had it.
Well, I believe, Your Honor, in Jackson, what the court held was that an intervening cause would not preclude liability where there exists a causal connection between the injury and the hospitalization. And in that case, Ms. Jackson was in a VA hospital being treated, and there was an incident with another patient that led to additional disability. So in that case, really what the holding turned on was whether an intervening cause could preclude liability.
Right, but the causal connection that was not severed by the intervening cause was the her mere fact of her being hospitalized.
I understand. However, yeah. In this case, I think our case is distinctive from that. We have a situation where he presents for respite care, essentially because his wife was going to have some surgery. And because she was his caregiver, he was not able to, you know, care for himself. He went to the VA hospital. And he was there for a period of 2 weeks. And then he went home. It is not clear, based on the medical evidence here, that his cancer is linked exactly to that time period when he was hospitalized by the VA. So I think that would be the distinction with Jackson, Your Honor.
Okay. You can proceed. Thank you.
Well, Counselor, I don't think Jackson necessarily implies a strict liability, that if something bad happens to me while I'm under VA care, all of a sudden the taxpayer picks up the tab. The intervening cause analysis, I think, is an interesting one, and I think supported by the record. But what level of deference are you suggesting, or do you suggest that this court give to the general counsel's opinion that was pointed out to you?
Well, certainly this court has the ability to review the general counsel opinion 5-2001 at implication here on a de novo basis. Certainly the board and the agency are bound by the findings, but the court at this level certainly may review its efficacy clearly on a de novo basis. We would submit, however, Your Honors, that the threshold element in this theory of recovery, a failure to diagnose theory of recovery, has not been satisfied by the medical evidence. And if we look at 5-2001, specifically the case that gave rise to that opinion, there was medical evidence in the record that specifically showed that the cardiac condition suffered by the claimant in that case should have been diagnosed by a VA doctor. We don't have that same factual predicate here. We're dealing in much murkier waters. Essentially, the only evidence we have here that there's any connection between his cancer and his VA treatment in this particular case is the appellant's allegation. Because we would submit, very respectfully, Your Honors, that the medical evidence does not support a finding that VA failed to diagnose anything.
I guess I'm interested in your position relative to the Haas case from the Federal Circuit and their suggestion that we need to give some level of deference to a general counsel opinion at this court. Understanding statutorily, the board is bound by it, right?
The board is bound by it, yes, right. Certainly. Certainly.
But I'm looking for your opinion as to what the Haas case does in terms of our level of deference, if anything.
Your Honor, that's an excellent question, and I'll be quite candid with you. I did not really look at Haas in regard to this case. I did not see the implication of Haas to this case, and I would be happy to prepare a supplemental answer for you, but I would be disingenuous if I tried to pretend that I knew what it said.
Well, I appreciate your candor. And I appreciate your candor in a supplemental brief indicating that the general counsel's opinion probably should have been cited to the court in the opening brief. In as much as the board is bound by it statutorily, it seems to me those things are somewhat important.
Certainly, they are, Your Honor. And I, if I may, Your Honor, the Secretary does submit, however, that your question is certainly valid, and I don't in any way want to appear disrespectful to you. All I mean to say is that part of the Secretary's argument is that the general counsel opinion is it's not necessary to weigh the efficacy of the general counsel opinion in order to decide this case. Nevertheless, I'm prepared to talk about the general counsel opinion if you would like to do that. However, with regard to Haas itself, I really can't honestly tell you how it would affect our case.
Well, then, let's talk about Gardner then a little bit. Distinguish for me, if you can, the Gardner case from the factual pattern that we have here.
Well, in Gardner, essentially, what Justice Souter, writing for the unanimous court, said was that the Secretary could not read a fault requirement into the old version of 1151. However, the Supreme Court did not write out a causal element. So 1151, in light of Brown, still has a causal element that must be established. So you must be able to show actual cause, direct cause, but for cause, between the VA treatment or hospitalization and the additional disability.
And that's sort of where I'm struggling right now, because it seems to me that bringing in a standard of care is typically a negligence concept. And if we are precluded from bringing in negligence by Gardner, how do we establish in a failure to diagnose case that there is causation?
Well, I would submit, Your Honor, that a failure to diagnose is a very unique theory of recovery. In order, and I think appellant's counsel brought this out, in order to fail to diagnose something, just the nomenclature itself insinuates that there must be some duty that has not been lived up to. that there must be some standard that must have been met. And so it looks like negligence, and it probably smells a little bit like negligence, but it really, that element is there so that the adjudicator can weigh the causal element. Is there a direct cause between the allegation and the actual VA treatment? And I think that is the reasoning underlying the general counsel opinion, Judge Lance. And I also think that's what the general counsel was attempting to do, was attempting to harmonize Brown with the idea of recognizing a cause of action that is well recognized in the common law and that would provide an additional means of recovery to many veterans. So it just so happens that in this particular case, the evidence really doesn't go beyond a mere allegation. And I think, Judge Sholin, that while the statute could be viewed as a strict liability statute, I think Judge Lance is on the right track. You still have to show cause in strict liability in tort. If you are harmed by a defective product, you would still, under strict products liability, you would still have to show that the product somehow harmed you and it was defective and the manufacturer that created it. You couldn't just sue all lawnmower manufacturers, for example. So there has to be some causal connection. And I think what the general counsel was doing when he crafted the opinion, they were struggling with the idea of how to harmonize the concept in Brown that there must be cause, but we can't show fault. So how do we do that if we're going to recognize this very unique cause of action, a failure to diagnose, that there must have been something to diagnose that the doctor failed to see. So there would have to be some standard to really weigh. And that really is the idea behind that element in the general counsel's opinion.
You started out by saying that the injury was the failure to diagnose, assuming there was mm-hmm. one, not the shortening of Mr. Roberson's life or the whatever greater amount of cancer before it was detected that had metastasized. One of the things I'm kind of struggling with also is then in a traditional malpractice case where, say, you leave the clamp in the surgery or whatever, then that would be the injury, or you cut off the leg, sort of not the actual consequence of it. And I think we typically treat it as the consequence of the treatment, like now I have back problems or knee problems or leg problems that Mr. Gardner had it as a result, not that the surgery was done incorrectly. And so it's the consequence, not the procedure. And I think in this case, you're saying it's the procedure, not the consequence.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. And I think if we look at the elements of 1151, you see there must be an injury of some sort, and it must result in additional disability. And I think in your hypothetical, what you're suggesting, if they leave a clamp in you, that's the injury. I would agree. It is the injury. But the additional disability is the infection that ensues and the fact that you have knee problems for the rest of your life. In this particular case where we're dealing with a cancer, a disease process like cancer, you have the injury is the failure to diagnose it. The additional disability is the loss of chance or the untimely death. That would be the additional disability element. Your Honors,
take my hypothetical then. I'm in the VA hospital for a knee replacement, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then 4 months later, I come up with a PSA elevation of 25, and I have prostate cancer that has metastasized through the body. Is it VA's, is there a failure to diagnose injury by VA?
I would submit, Your Honor, no, there is not. And that's why we need to know what the standard of care is. Because, and while I'm not a doctor, I will walk out on this limb, there is, if you present with a knee problem, there really, I'm pretty sure, there is no standard of care that would say that the doctor is required to check your PSA count because it's completely, wholly unrelated to the symptomatology that you're presenting with. It's a completely different, you know, body system and has nothing to do with your knee. Now, if it could be shown that somehow under the standard of care that that doctor should have checked your PSA count and that his failure to have done that caused you to develop prostate problems, then yes, I believe that a cause of action could lie, but you would have to have the medical evidence to show that, and you would have to establish the standard of care in an effort to show cause.
So if Mr. Robeson presented in April of 65 for whatever reason, it would be reasonable to presume that, like in all medical visits, the doctor listens to your heart and says, breathe.
Yes, and they did, Your Honor. And if you look at the medical record in March of 1995, and I can even give you the page number, on page 686, he presented for the respite care, and he had symptoms of coryza and pharyngitis, which in layman's terms are a runny nose and sore throat. And on record at 689, they did check his lungs, and his lungs were clear. Now, I don't know if a lung x-ray was taken, and I'm not certain to what extent how significant his symptoms of a cold were at that time. That's not really indicated by the record.
But you're saying that there was medical evidence then that his lungs were checked and they were determined to be clear?
That is correct. That appears at 689.
And that was in April.
That was in March of 1995, which was the last period of VA hospitalization. Yes, Your Honor. Yes. Your Honors, the Secretary submits that the medical evidence here does not support a finding that VA failed to diagnose Mr. Roberson's disease process. As such, the Secretary would submit that the Board decision should not be disturbed. And I see that none of us have really addressed the other accrued benefits issue, but the Secretary would also submit that the reasons or bases provided in that portion of the decision are also worthy of affirmance. And if there are no further questions, I'll sit down.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Ms. Booth.
Thank you, Your Honor. This is not a standard of care issue. Standard of care is a common law tort concept. And in my view, the real meaning or the significant holding of...
Excuse me for interrupting.
Certainly.
With the buzzing, whatever that is, and I suppose it's some type of construction that we shouldn't have going on right now, and your very feminine soft voice, I can have a difficult time hearing, so please use the microphone.
I'll shout out, Your Honor.
Thank you. Shout out.
This is not a standard of care issue. Standard of care is a tort concept. And in my view, the significant holding of Jackson as applied to this case is that Jackson made clear what Gardner suggests but doesn't flat out say, and that is you cannot adopt a common law tort concept by reading it into the statute. Congress knows how to do that. Gardner said it's plain. There's no standard of, there's no fault requirement. The Secretary's, or the, I'm sorry, the General Counsel's opinion, I think, is really just an end run around that by creating this dichotomy between errors of omission versus commission.
Do you believe then that O1151 presented a theory that if you incur a disease while in VA treatment, whether you're presenting for it or not, that it would be, quote, service-connectable?
Well, you also have, there are other elements that are explained in 3.358. For example, if the additional injury is the natural consequence of the pre-existing injury, then that's not service-connectable under the no-fault provision. If it's the intended consequence, the example Gardner gives is where a veteran goes into the hospital, to a VA hospital with gangrene, has his leg amputated. That's the intended consequence. He cannot later get service connection for loss of a leg. Failure to diagnose, I think, is a wholly different situation than whether something was the intended consequence. The veteran presented for evaluation of his declining health. Whether VA doctors, during their examination, and I would point out the March 1995 X-ray is not relevant because that's still within that period of time where it's possible he had not had the onset of his cancer yet. That would seem to suggest that's true. But we have another several months after that before he was diagnosed. And Dr. Pritchard says this is small cell carcinoma is very aggressive, very quick growing. That would certainly be consistent with development in the lung after March. The CT scan in June, which shows no evidence of abnormality other than recording his old infarct, would certainly support that there had not been brain metastasis at that point. So there is still that window between April and May into June where, had the veteran been diagnosed with the lung cancer, then, according to Dr. Pritchard, it's responsive to chemo and responsive to radiation, and that's not disputed by the VA's physicians.
I'd like to back up to something you just said, that there are limits under Gardner, for example, if it's an intended consequence of the treatment or if it's a natural progression of the disease. Well, what kind of limit would you place on a failure to diagnose? Because I think, for example, the hypothetical Judge Green gave you, you said, no, I don't think that would necessarily, or that would be a closer case. Or, you know, say a veteran comes in for a hearing exam and turns out to have cancer that is treated. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to sort of, in a real world way, figure out how we would apply this somewhere between Jackson and having to have fault, and where do we draw the line and how?
Well, we have to draw the line someplace short of imposing a standard of care and reviewing whether the doctor or the VA medical provider breached that standard of care, because Gardner says we can't do that. I think we look back to the VA examination, of course, itself, not just hospitalization, not just the administration of medical care, but the VA examination itself can be the act. Whether I don't have the regulation with me, but at 3.358, is this the 1994 version? Oh, sorry, 96. Okay, we're talking about natural progress of the disease. Compensation is not payable. However, I would note the last part of that sentence says, for which the training or the hospitalization, et cetera, was authorized. A failure to diagnose case is never going to come within the natural consequences or natural progress of the disease case, because the veteran didn't authorize non-treatment of his cancer. He couldn't have, because it wasn't diagnosed. I think the plain meaning of Gardner and looking at the regulations is that VA's really got very, very broad 1151 responsibility under the old version.
So if somebody did present for a hearing test in 1995 and turned out to have cancer at that time and VA didn't diagnose it, it would be actionable.
Well, once again, is the failure to diagnose the result of the examination? And that's where I think it's a close call. That isn't present in Mr. Robertson's case.
So you're linking, in your case, the fact that he presented with certain symptoms that should have triggered further examination by the VA?
Well, yes, although that may be too narrowly. What I really am saying is, in your case, if he's presented for a specific purpose and there's not a continuing relationship of care as there was in Mr. Robertson's case, I think that could well limit the 1151 liability.
How do you evaluate what needed to be done?
Well, I can't tell you at this moment how I would draw that bright line, Your Honor, because I don't think it's present in this case. Again, had Mr. Robertson gone to a VA emergency room and said, I'm feeling weak and I can't speak properly, and what Riverside did, and they evaluated him and said, we don't find any more stroke residuals.
And also did not diagnose him with cancer at that time.
They did not. They did not. But they don't have any responsibility to do that. The tort concept takes us down a whole different road. What was the duty of care owed by the Riverside physicians to a patient who presents at the emergency room in terms of his overall care? That wasn't the relationship Mr. Robertson had with the VA outpatient center. So I think it's highly distinguishable on that basis.
Well, the relationship he had with the VA outpatient center, I take it, is that he had medical care authorized for what? A service-connected disability?
Much broader than that, Your Honor.
What else?
If the page numbers are cited in my statement of facts, but in the 1993-94 period, for example, he did indeed treat for stroke residuals and had rehab, but he also was seen for prostate problems. He was seen for arthritis, I believe, that is, and it's not clear whether that's related to the service.
And the rule that you would have us do here is that when you present for any of those types of conditions, whether they be service-connected or not, if during the examination of those conditions a VA doctor fails to diagnose another condition, that other condition would be service-connectable under 1151.
I think under the old no-fault provision, that's pretty much on the mark, and that's precisely what Congress changed in 1997. But I think under the old 1151, Gardner cuts a very wide swath.
So even if you had a pre-existing condition before you came in for the treatment, you have to diagnose that pre-existing condition.
Well, did that pre-existing condition, the other inquiry would be, did it worsen, and is the worsening of it related to the examination?
Worsening means something else other than the natural progress?
Well, the aggravation of it, which is caused by the failure to diagnose. And that would require consideration under 3.358b2. Is that aggravation part of the natural progress of the disease within the meaning of that provision? I don't think all these issues get resolved in Mrs. Robertson's case because they don't present all of them. But not all the issues that your hypotheticals are presenting, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And may I take a moment to apologize to Judge Lance that I did not cite the VA General Counsel opinion, but I will honestly tell you I was not aware of it and should have been. So there was
apparently
no intent to.
One of those opinions that not everybody was aware of.
Well, including the board.
Thank you for the apology.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is submitted. We will greet the counsel and then the Court will adjourn.
I know. I like wash my hands 100 times after touching it.